Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
UK Tech Weekly Podcast.
Don't need money. Don't need fame. Don't need no credit card to ride this train, because it's the UK Tech Weekly Podcast. Hello, listener, and welcome to this edition of the UK Tech Weekly Podcast. Simply the best weekly tech podcast, arriving in your ears every Friday like the first breath after a coma. This is the UK Tech Weekly Podcast, a weekly spritz of infotainment from the editors of PC Advisor, Techworld, Macworld UK, and Computerworld UK. Every Friday, we form up an audio dance troupe, busting in audio moves on our strip of audio lino in order to bring you no more than 40 minutes of informed tech chat on the hot tech topics of the past 7 days. Don't forget to subscribe, review, and tell your friends. And if you'd like to be associated with this prime slice of audio beef, you can sponsor us. Get in touch at editor@idg.co.uk or via the @UKTechPodcast Twitter feed. I'm Matt Egan, Editorial Director of IDG UK, and today I am delighted to be joined in conversation by the somewhat chiselled Henry Burrell, Staff Writer of PC Advisor and Macworld UK.
Easy now.
The nicely grizzled Christopher Manassians, also a Staff Writer at PC Advisor and Macworld UK.
Hello.
And the lemon-drizzled David Price, Acting Editor of Macworld UK.
All right.
Also, as ever on the decks, is producer Chris Martin. Say hi, Chris.
Hello.
This week, we are talking games, graphics cards, and mobile networks. Are you sitting comfortably? Then I'll begin. Games! I want to live forever! I want to learn how to fly! Hi! David Price. It's been a huge week in the always serious world of games and gaming. Massive new games titles, and a couple of brouhahas. Let's play.
Yes, a big week for games. We are starting to get the early manoeuvrings ahead of E3, which is the big gaming, what do you call it, show? The big
show. That's when sort of typically the big games are announced.
Yes, or shown off. And that's in June, so which we are heading towards at precipitate rate. Is precipitate a word?
Quickly.
Anyway, so this week, Battlefield 1, the latest. Weird that they called it Battlefield 1, but we'll get onto that in a minute. But that's the latest in the Battlefield shooting game franchise that's been announced, and its rival, Call of Duty Infinite Warfare, or Call of Duty Infinite Dislikes, as it's getting called. They've both been announced. We've had trailers for both of those, which have caused a great deal of excitement and, as you say, controversy, respectively.
Let's talk about the Dislikes thing first.
Okay, so it's Call of Duty Infinite Warfare. It's set in space, which is a sort of semi-new thing for the franchise. They've done it a bit. But these are traditionally, both franchises, quasi-historical shooting franchises. Generally, they're set in either real conflicts or analogues of real conflicts.
So like when little Matt used to run around with a stick?
Yes.
Pointing at his friends.
Were you pretending to be...
Pointing your stick at your friends?
Yeah.
You were playing out a real historical war.
Well, we'll get on to... Yeah, exactly. We'll get... it's something that occurred to me
being
today.
Napoleon. Yeah. Or something. So Call of Duty...
Height-based gag.
Yeah. I didn't even think of that.
Napoleon was actually 5'8", which is my height.
He was... Well, in his day, 5'8", was average. In our day... Yeah.
if not top. Anyway, so...
People don't like it anyway. So there's been, I was looking up, there's been 18 million views on the trailer for Call of Duty Infinite Warfare on YouTube, and 1.8 million dislikes, which maths fans will immediately recognise as a 10% dislike ratio.
That is a strong dislike ratio.
Which I'm told, actually, that a lot of people have made multiple accounts in order to do multiple dislikes.
Okay.
So it's possible that there isn't actually that many people, but the number of people is, they are very strongly motivated in their dislike of this game. So,
but then in the world of, say, movies or even books, often the failures are the things that don't arouse strong feelings. And anything for which you could argue strongly positively or strongly negatively tends to have a bit of an afterlife and success.
They're both going to be successful games, right. Absolutely. Our game expert, Lewis, told me before I came in that Call of Duty games always come in for hate, and people still buy and play them.
Did he
regardless.
Say they're always hated on?
I think he might have done, yeah.
Is he
I think he might have used the phrase the haters
the
as
haters.
Well.
Haters got hate.
Haters do gotta hate, I hear. But yeah, Battlefield 1, meanwhile, which I find a much more interesting idea, that's had 26 million views on its trailer, which is only a bit more, but it's only had 24,000 dislikes, which is 0.1%.
a much smaller percentage, math fans.
A much smaller. 0.1 is smaller than 10. And one thing that I thought was quite interesting about Battlefield 1 is the sort of slightly cool response in some quarters related to the fact they've chosen World War 1, which is an odd choice in a lot of ways.
So I was thinking about this earlier on today, which is why I brought up my playing army games as a kid with sticks thing, because it is kind of the same thing. Because instinctively, I'm repelled and appalled by the idea of a game that's based in the trenches of the Western Front in World War One, but then the more I sort of question myself on that, I'm totally inconsistent, because I'm comfortable with movies that exist for entertainment based on such events, and we are as a culture much more comfortable with the Second World War, weirdly. I mean, like there are sort of humorous films about Nazis going to the moon and so on and so forth. I was walking in from the station this morning. I passed a pub that was advertising for new staff, and it had the General Kitchener finger pointing out, saying, "We need you," you know, which was used to recruit literally millions of people to new armies. So it kind of intrigued me, because the idea of being for entertainment, trying to in some form be in the shoes of somebody who's in the trenches in the First World War. You know, 100 years ago today, the Battle of Verdun was going on. In a couple of months, we're going to get to the 100-year anniversary of the Battle of the Somme, where, you know, 60,000 people were casualties in a day. It just feels awful. But as I say, I'm comfortable with movies about the First World War, and we seem to have a much different culture around other conflicts. So
it is. It's interesting, the inconsistency. Part of it, I think, is games in the popular mind are still felt to be, because I mean, it's fair enough because they have the word game in the title, but they seem trivial and they seem juvenile, and people assume that anything that is featured in them will be thereby trivialized or you know, made into a play toy.
There's a bit of a generational thing in that as well, isn't there? Yeah. Which is that even though these days demographically pretty much everyone plays games, up to and including people who are of retirement age, it's still perceived as a young person's pursuit.
It's right, but it isn't anymore.
Yeah.
That's it. And I strongly feel that games should be able to portray anything that they want to in the same way that books and films and so on should.
But then the other thing I came to, and I'm not comfortable with this, but the other thing that I realised I was feeling was that there is a difference between what you might call passive art, such as movies, where you're watching something, and actually movies that's all wrong anyway, because you bring your own experience to watching a movie or reading a book. But the very fact of a game is that you're playing and you are in it. And that just, because World War One represents such a huge cultural thing, I wondered if, even more than World War Two, weirdly.
Well, in Britain and France, I think World War One have a particular place in our psyche, because, I mean, there were more casualties in this country in World War One, But World War II was a bloodier conflict. You look at something like Stalingrad.
Yeah.
Is almost more horrifying. I think it's because the Nazis were in World War II. There was a clear enemy. Mm. And in the same way that video games like to put zombies in, so that it's a dehumanized enemy that you can simultaneously get a kick out of exploding their brain, but it's not a human, so it's okay.
Yeah.
Nazis represent that in a historical
parallel. A comfortable body, a black hat. Yeah. Exactly. But I do wonder as well if there's a bit of a loss of innocence thing about the World War One as well, because World War One was closer in time now to the Franco-Prussian War, which was a cavalry war, it's 100 years ago, but it was the first mechanized war. So yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm interested to hear what you guys, Henry and Christopher, think about this, because also there is a bit of an age gap between us, and I wonder if it's even your viewpoint's different on that score.
Well, I will say I don't game that much, but when I couldn't believe that the dislike story became a story. It was like on the BBC and everything. But from what David, you said about those stats, I would have thought that the general outrage about making a game about World War One, you'd have had your millions of dislikes. Because I presume there's a lot of people who are watching it are going to be gamers. But then the figures that are actually the news stories, gamers don't like space, no war in space, space is bad. Yeah. But then, like, really, like, would you say like 0.1% if we're counting? That I don't know. Maybe they just don't want to buy a game from World War One. There doesn't seem to be any gaming outrage. It's more just us sitting there, seeing the trailer, and going, "Ooh." I mean, I completely agree that. I mean, I never really got why the glorification of war within a game hasn't been picked up more in our culture.
Yeah.
I mean, you think about Medal of Honor, all those games that go way further back. They just sort of were fine. I don't know.
Well, that's the thing for me, is the key thing, is whether it glorifies it or not.
Yeah.
And the odd thing is that it's the games that are explicitly anti-war that more often get criticised. Mm. The big one in my generation was Cannon Fodder in about, I think, 93. And Min Campbell, who later became leader of the Lib Dems, he called it monstrous, and the Daily Star got on board, and the British Legion, because they all felt that it was...
It's a very strange coalition.
It really is. But they felt that it was making light of casualties of war.
Sure.
Because it treated various conflicts. But actually, that game is explicitly anti-war, and it's I found it quite moving as a teenager. It was the first sort of understanding I'd had. Because you participate in it, because of the interactive element, these are people you're controlling and you're sending them to die. And then after each mission, their gravestones are littered on this hillside. And that actually is for me a better way of dealing with war, even though it was also humorous. It was also satirical.
Yeah.
Something like Medal of Honor, where it's actually saying, you know, patriotism, gung-ho.
Well, that's why
that's worse.
I mean, I know nothing about games, but surely a game that is based in a current or relatively recent conflict is in some ways more problematic, because you're kind of playing at a thing that you could potentially be actually involved in.
Well, there is a troubling current issue with how closely the US military works with games developers. They use games to recruit for the army, and they use games to train people in the army.
Right.
And you have actual arms manufacturers who work with video games makers to have their stuff put into games, and that sort of thing is much more worrying for me. The idea that it is encouraging people to think that war is normal and glorious. But you know, something like this, I don't know exactly how they're going to treat the World War One. There's a game I like on the iPad called Valiant Heart, which is set in World War One, which was released for the centenary of the start of World War One, so it's a couple of years old now. But it's sort of cartoonish in graphics, but it's about the impact of the war. It's an adult piece of art about an adult subject. I think it's good the way that games are expanding in recent years to deal with things like that.
Well, I mean, and a few years ago, of course, we had Frogger, which dealt with the...
Don't make jokes about that. My dad was killed by a frog.
Well, no, I was thinking, you know, frogs crossing the road in springtime can be quite, you know, there can be a massacre in rural Surrey, so... And they clog up your tyres as well. Let's go around the room and say, COD or BAT? Beautiful game or silly games? COD or BAT? COD or BAT? COD or BAT, David Price?
BAT.
Okay. Henry Burrell, COD or BAT?
COD.
It's BF, but I'll go for BF.
It's Battlefield. I didn't know it was BF. I'm not going to go with BF. Can I change my answer?
Yeah, but a BF isn't... I mean, a COD is a creature, as is a bat. That was the whole thing.
Could be your boyfriend as well, if you...
BF? BFF?
You swing that way.
BFF?
BFF? Best friends for life.
Let's ponder that for a couple of seconds, and then we'll come back for the next section. Christopher Manassians. Because of GPU, these things I go through. Could have been Under the Boardwalk. I was thinking about that one as well.
Yeah.
What is on the cards for graphics cards?
Oh, that rhymed. Quite like that one. So NVIDIA have announced Pascal, and Pascal is the architecture behind the new GTX 1080 and 1070. The two new graphics cards, which are raising a lot of eyebrows in the industry right now, simply because of their performance that's been showcased at the NVIDIA event that took place just a few days ago. The reason why it's interesting is because, one, its price, the release price of the 1080 is coming at £449.
So that sounds immediately hugely expensive, but you're about to tell me it's not?
It's not, because it is packing more punch than a £1,000 graphics card.
Kapow!
So it is really raising a lot of eyebrows in terms of how the industry's moved into different architectures. So, for example, the new architecture uses a different nanometer graphical processing unit.
What are we down to in terms of nanometers?
16. If I'm not mistaken, it's 16 nanometers, which is really ridiculously
that's
low.
That's more
nanometers.
Oh, that's smaller, less nanometers.
Yeah, I think I remember when 40 like nanometers was exciting. Is that
right? Yeah, that's right, yeah. And the previous one was 28, which was...
Oh, that's far too many nanometers.
Too much.
This is all about, just briefly to get technical, just because I want to show that I know some of this. It's all about the accuracy of manufacturing, right? So the smaller you can get that down to, the more... accurately, you can create silicon that will perform faster.
Exactly, pretty much. Yeah.
Boom.
In a nutshell.
Very good.
Or Googled.
I got back a long way in this game.
So, yeah, I mean, the graphics cards are just really exciting due to their prices, due to their performance that they're bringing 1 to 2 times faster than the previous generation graphics cards, and they come in at the same price. So you do think, if you're going to be buying a new graphics card, hold fire and buy these ones. And currently they're only on the Founders Edition. Now, the Founders Edition is previously known as a reference card.
So this is actually made by NVIDIA rather than made by a graphics card manufacturer.
Exactly.
I'm on fire.
And this will now, for the first time, only be sold by NVIDIA, whereas previously you'd get like resellers like Overclockers or Amazon selling the Founders Edition.
So I wasn't even thinking about this question, but what is the point of third-party board manufacturers?
So... it's more of a what is the point of a reference board.
Right.
It's almost the other way I would see it. It's because third-party manufacturers such as MSI, for example, or Asus or any of these guys, they produce often better spec'd PCBs. So they sort of take the
reference and then they...
overclock it, generally speaking. And a stock overclock, so that means... It's done by the factory and it hasn't been done by a user, so therefore it won't affect its performance negatively.
And presumably they then have a warranty against it?
They have a warranty with it as well, and on top of that, they put usually a cooler. So obviously AMD were previously known and notoriously badly represented in the community for having bad coolers on their reference coolers, reference design, sorry. And say MSI got the dual Forza design, which is a dual fan, which really does cool at really silent... really silently, is that the word? So that is the benefits of having it aftermarket.
Yeah.
And on top of that, you got a lot of competition. So when you've got, say, EVGA, Gigabyte, MSI, Asus, all fighting against each other...
Oh, totally.
You get loads of price wars.
Well, I can see it from NVIDIA's point of view, because they put up the reference board, they get paid whoever's graphics card gets sold. But if you're that third-party manufacturer, that's a tough game to be in. It's a bit like being a Windows OEM. You've got to make something that's sufficiently interesting to stand out, but your margin's always getting squeezed because you've got to fight for the lowest price as well.
Exactly. And for us consumers, it just makes it really fun to watch, or good for us, for our bank balances. So
how does this fit in with... I know the answer to this, by the way. I'm just prompting Christopher to say.
Okay.
So the vast majority of laptops and PCs these days will be sold with Intel system on a chip.
Yep.
CPUs. Mm-hmm. They don't need a discrete graphics card. Mm-hmm. But
that these graphics cards are for gamers, essentially.
Yeah, so they're a full-blown graphics card at the moment, and often the case is with NVIDIA, even, I'm not going to say AMD, because they're... Anyway, yeah, generally with NVIDIA...
Don't open that kind of worms.
I don't want to open that. So, yeah, generally they will produce the M version of their graphics card. So, for example, the GTX 1080 M would be made for mobile gaming, so therefore laptop gaming. So often you'll find laptops with inbuilt graphics cards or just their NVIDIA iGPU graphics cards.
So I'm getting the impression from the previous section, Christopher, that you are very much a PC gamer rather than a console gamer.
Oh yeah, for sure. I used to be a massive console gamer. I had a Xbox, original Xbox, and Xbox 360. I played on the PS2 for a long time as well.
But now do you look back on those days as if they were like you were wearing a terrible 70s?
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Suits or something.
Well, I saw it as more of a, because the way I transitioned was, I used to be a PC gamer when I was really young, realized I needed a better graphics card, which is funny what we're talking about right now, and then that was too expensive and I couldn't be bothered to do with all the driver compatibility issues and the game compatibility. So I went to a console with Need for Speed Underground, fantastic game by the way, I was on console for 6 years, then moved on back to PC because I was like, I just want better performance and I can afford it now. Sure. So we've got I'm just plugging it in over here. We've got an under £500 PC build guide. So if you guys are looking for a good
PC,
go ahead and check out my, our build guide.
That's on,
that.
On PC Advisor, yeah?
It is indeed. So a little plug.
Likes it. So what about you guys? Henry, you said you weren't a gamer. So I presume the graphics card in your machine means next to nothing to you.
That is correct. I have literally no idea what just happened. I've been thinking a lot about Call of Duty Pro Skater 2, though, since we were talking about skating in COD Upwards. So I was just kind of thinking about that as a mashup.
Cool.
Someone else should talk now.
But then, so just to set that back to you, Christopher. So there is, so to the non-gamer, there's no value to a great graphics card, or is there? I mean, does it affect things like watching high-definition content?
Well, all graphics cards, I would say, in the last 10 years would probably be able to handle high-definition content.
Sure.
But more the fact of, I think what David was asking me prior to the podcast was, what are the other features that come out with these graphics cards? And there's a few interesting things like NVIDIA Ansel, which basically brings cool screenshots functionalities to your games.
I've got a number for that.
Go ahead.
Looks at his notes.
61,440 by 34,560.
Well, that's the resolution.
That's the resolution it can capture screenshots at.
But then why would you ever need that? If you were going to blow it up the size of a building.
I don't think you'd ever need that sort of resolution, but it's more the fact of the Ansel technology brings. Normally you screenshot, it just takes where you're looking at in the game.
Yeah.
Whereas with certain games that will have Ansel built into them, so developers would have to actually adopt it when they're developing the game or when they're doing updates to the game, is that it takes different angles that you can't see in the game. So, for example, if I was swinging my sword and the sword was in front of my face, as I was doing, in a game, obviously.
Can we ever have a podcast without some kind of innuendo?
And so anyway, it would just take different screenshots from different angles.
Sure.
And it would look cool because you could make a collage of it and like a kind of like Instagram-esque post on it, which like, look at the swinging of my sword. Hey, how you doing?
Two ideas we've just had. Okay, we've got this Call of Duty skate mashup, and then you've got a kind of Tinder stroke gaming mashup.
I'm down for that. I'll probably get more Tinder matches on that.
Sword swinger or sword something swinger. Similar. Without the ER at the end, sword swinger. Food for thought.
Wow.
David, I'm going to throw this over to you now. You are a gamer, self-avowed.
I am, but in a
you're
very
a Mac guy.
Way.
So, you're not, I know the answer, but again, just imagine, we're talking to the listener here.
Yeah.
And, you don't particularly game on consoles either.
I mostly game, this may actually disqualify me from calling myself a gamer, I mostly game on iPad. And my favourite game, I think of all time, is FTL. And FTL has very, very simple graphics. And I do consider myself a gamer, but I don't really care about graphics in general. So this means this sort of announcement really leaves me cold because I don't need it.
Christopher, is David the scum of the earth as far as you're concerned?
In fact, he's completely the opposite. And ooh. I love that because...
What's the opposite of the scum of the earth?
He's the cleaning product of the sky.
Well, going back to what you just said, David, I mean, graphics are not everything. And a gamer that plays purely on graphics is not a true gamer. No matter whoever tells you otherwise.
Yeah, that's right.
It's honestly, you could play on...
I'm going to bring Chris Martin in here. Do you agree, Chris?
What was it?
Carry on, Christopher.
Well, graphics do add a nice little dimension to a game. And obviously, the more pleasant the viewing experience, it's great. But you shouldn't consider yourself not a gamer if you can't game on 4K ultra resolution through four different monitors and all of this shebang. Sure, these graphics cards will allow you to do that, probably not that amount of monitors and that resolution, but anyway, it's something that adds to a gaming experience, but it shouldn't be the purpose of a gaming experience. A gamer, to me, is someone who's playing Candy Crush to someone who's playing, Fallout 4 or Counter-Strike.
Well, people still play Tetris today.
Exactly.
Because it's such a simple but beautifully executed game.
Yeah.
It's a very elegant design.
Cool. Okay. Well, before we take another short break, let's quickly go around the room. David Price, chairman of the board or really, really bored?
Chairman of the board.
Henry Burrell.
Chairman of the board?
Oh, interesting. Mm. Christopher Manassias.
I think it's pretty obvious, isn't
chairman
it?
Chairman of the board. Chris Martin?
Hey.
We'll take a short break and we'll be back in 2 seconds. Henry Burrell. E falling. Can you tell me why 3 is not the magic number? Or is it?
I'm on Vodafone, which definitely isn't the magic number. But yeah, so I was going to talk about a couple of things that are to do with mobile networks. Not the immediately most sexy topic. But this week, EE basically done a tweet and got 3 banned. So we've all seen that advert with the 3 guy that looks like a Muppet, but it's not a Muppet. He's like really happy about all the 4G he gets.
Jackson,
that's it. Yeah.
Is he the guy who sang the E17 song?
Think so. The fist bumping puppet.
Yeah. So irritating.
Exactly. Well, no longer, because the advert campaign the 3 used for that called it the Undisputed and said it was sort of the unmatched network in the UK. EE, all it did was tweet a picture of the dictionary definition of undisputed. It kicked up a bit of a fuss, and now the advert can't run in its current form because it's not undisputed.
Because there is dispute about whether 3 is the best network.
Indeed. And then that takes it sort of to maybe what should be a larger story, I feel, is that Hutchison, who owns 3, isn't allowed to buy O2.
From Telefonica.
Indeed. It's not allowed, which is sort of on the face of things slightly weird, considering the European Commission did allow BT to purchase EE. It can get a little bit dull, so I try and keep it zesty.
Well, here's my thought as a consumer, right?
Yeah.
On the one hand, more competition is almost always good. And I remember when that most recent purchase was made that you just described, You know, there were these dire warnings coming from, I presume, from the other brands, but it was all kind of below the line, yeah, about how it was going to add 20 quid a year or whatever to your bill. I just put that somewhat in the air. But the interesting thing with all infrastructure, and certainly all connectivity infrastructure, is one of the biggest problems we have in this stupid country, I love this country, I'm just on this particular issue, is that we've got, four different networks, all of whom use some different infrastructure in different places. They do share in more rural areas,
yeah,
but what are we talking about now? 3E, Vodafone, O2, are there any other major networks out
there? No, those are the four major ones, and then you've got your subsidiaries like Virgin Media or Tesco
Mobile. They buy places on other people's.
Yeah.
So if I'm outside of a large metropolitan area, we all work in central London, live around London, so by and large, this is not an issue. But if I'm outside a large metropolitan area, I'm basically reliant on the fact that one of those four has found it economic to put infrastructure in place. So actually, it doesn't always help the consumer that there are four different companies, because they're interested in making money, essentially. Yeah. And that doesn't necessarily mean they want the best coverage for everybody. So I don't know what I think. What do you think, Henry?
I was having a think about it, and the reasons given for blocking 3 buying O2, I mean, this is putting it very basically, is it's because it's one mobile operator trying to merge with another mobile operator.
Right.
And like you say, bringing down competition in that way, you would risk prices rising with nobody to combat that, or being able to combat that. I think maybe BT buying EE was allowed, not only because they got in there first, but also because BT doesn't own any... well, it's got BT Mobile now, but it owes much less mobile infrastructure.
So BT is really complicated. So this was, yeah, BT, the consumer company, rather than BT, the BT Open World, who like in, have the,
yeah, OpenReach, yeah, indeed, yeah, yeah. So it's like the guys who run BT Sport, basically.
Sure.
They bought EE, but they're not going to rebrand it. They haven't really so far messed with subscribers and how their service is delivered. It's kind of just bought it as an asset. Whereas there was the thinking that 3 and O2 merging would become a huge sort of monolith,
sure,
to raise prices. I mean, and also that there was a good point when I read into it a bit further, from a competition point of view, Vodafone and O2, like you said, for sometimes rural reasons, share some, yeah, spectrum, and EE shares some with 3.
Okay.
So if 3 were to buy O2, that holding company would have like control of all the different masts in the UK.
Imagine if we had like publicly owned masts all over the country. Just throwing it out there, guys.
That's what we should do. We should nationalise it. It's such a crucial thing these days.
I think so. I mean, I'm being slightly controversial, but I always make the analogy with the railways, in that there are certain things even an old trot like me can understand, that it makes sense to introduce competition. But when it's infrastructure, it rarely makes sense. Mm-hmm. With the railways, if you could have two different companies competing on the same lines, fair enough. But why would you ever sell off the lines? Because the companies exist to make money. So why should they invest in stuff that's not going to return a dividend for a long time? Yeah. And it's the same way with the network. So again, I'm really conflicted. I'm not saying it would be a good thing to have one monolithic network run by a commercial organisation. But the current situation, well, I don't think it's great. Let's see. What do you guys think? First of all, who is everyone with in terms of a mobile network? David?
I don't know.
You don't know?
Isn't that terrible?
That's amazing. Henry, you're with Vodafone.
Yeah.
I
hate Vodafone.
Okay. Christopher?
Funny enough, you mentioned those companies. I was with 3.
Yeah.
And moved down to EE.
And why did you move?
So 3 doesn't actually own most of their network.
Yeah,
they use most of EE's network.
Sure.
And therefore, when I did a lot of speed
tests...
And they're
often second in the queue. Although exactly. They claim not, actually. But
they claim not.
World.
Yeah, but I mean, I did... back at uni, I did a dissertation on networks.
Here we go.
And it was Free Mobile in France versus Orange, which Orange was the equivalent of EE,
yeah,
and Free Mobile was the equivalent of 3.
Yeah.
Long story short, Free has gone so popular that now Orange wants to buy Free, which is just crazy. In terms of like a competition point of view and in terms of the network infrastructure. What I don't get is how on earth is EE, how was EE formed in terms of Orange and T-Mobile being merged and now being allowed to be bought by BT whilst 3 can't be merged? Cash money, basically. It baffles me. But then,
from a consumer point of view, the reason you changed was because better network experience, right?
Exactly. So infrastructure is really important to me.
I'm with O2, generally speaking, never had a problem with it. My wife's with EE. her only real sort of consideration is price and does it work in our house, basically. Even though we've got Wi-Fi, it's kind of in the areas in which she is most recently. Henry, you suggested, as many people do, and it's interesting because Vodafone is hugely advertising at the minute around how awesome their network is. It's about this 30-day money-back guarantee. But traditionally, it's all hearsay. Vodafone has been considered the crappy network.
It's getting a lot of bad rep, not necessarily for its performance. To be fair, I can't really fault that. It's more the customer service.
Right.
I'm overcharged every single month on my current contract. And every time I call them up and they say they fix it, it still happens. But anyway, I'll get very angry about that.
But still you're with them?
I'm stuck in a contract.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so when that contract comes up,
I will not be...
And what will be the main focus of your... hunt? You're going to get loads of calls.
Yeah, no. I think the main thing for the consumer is the price, but that often gets lost in at least the UK market because it's so based on what smartphone people want.
Yeah,
and the subsidies of that, people will generally pay a premium with the network that can basically offer them the iPhone on the first day.
Totally.
I wouldn't be surprised. But then I can see from an infrastructure point of view that it gets a little bit unfair somewhat on the operators because it's really difficult to get coverage everywhere.
Of course it is, yeah. We're in central London, we're on O2.
Yeah.
We can see the mast from our office. It's on the top of the British Library. And O2 reception in this building is really spotty. So,
yeah. Well, it's just physics. It's a sort of a
building
with
walls. So many networks. And, yeah, buildings with walls.
Which is where Wi-Fi comes in. Obviously, you've got Wi-Fi at work, Wi-Fi at home. But then I think some people feel that they should have public Wi-Fi for free. Mm. But a lot of companies that run that public Wi-Fi infrastructure are like, hold on a minute, just because everyone has a phone, everyone's mobile first now, and you have a reliance on the expensive contract they've paid for, people kind of feel, wait, well, where's my own building Wi-Fi? Mm. But those companies are like, no, you can't have that for free.
Yeah, well, exactly, because how would they then make money?
Yeah, exactly.
It's because they often people will compare it to other countries.
Yeah.
South Korea, unbelievable. Like, you've got the internet in the train whilst it's moving, not at the platform, but you've got it also at the platform.
But that is heavily subsidised by
exactly,
isn't it?
And also horrible. Imagine having the internet on the train. Everybody's there, and they're not...
I imagine having the internet on the train.
Let me take
you to Southwest Trains, and you can experience this imaginary...
I mean, on the underground, I like that there should occasionally be moments of disconnection.
No, I agree. It's funny, because, our global CEO, who's a man called Michael, I was talking to him about this recently, and he was saying that he was really frustrated because he'd got... This guy gets on planes 4 days a week, at least. And he was saying, oh, the flight over from the States, they didn't have onboard Wi-Fi. And I was like, I didn't say this to him. I was like, you maniac. Surely like that 6 or 7 hours where you can just completely switch off. If that was me, I love journeys like that.
Yeah.
I actively, especially because since becoming a father, flying somewhere on my own is the dream.
I had that recently. I had a flight which for various reasons my family were not on. And they sat me next to a child whose parents weren't with him. So I ended up being like a surrogate dad. It was awful.
What are the chances?
Can't believe
you shouldn't have been wearing your world's best dad t-shirt. Yeah, so I was going to ask about public Wi-Fi because, you know, there was a time when this was considered to be, the answer to our network issues. And certainly in less developed countries, the infrastructure is not going to come under the ground. It's going to come from the sky. You know, most people who are getting online now in South Asia or in Africa or in South America who are getting online for the first time are doing so through mobile devices. What's our experience of using public Wi-Fi in the UK? In London, it's generally pretty good, I think, as long as you're prepared to sign up to various different accounts.
Well, that's the thing. You get faced with those splash pages, which people get annoyed at. But, I mean, companies are kind of... Not one company owns all that Wi-Fi, so you've got the cloud in London, and BT owns quite a lot of Wi-Fi as well. But then some of them are just like local businesses that own Wi-Fi, and they need it because people come in and buy that extra coffee.
Yeah.
But they need those pages to gather sort of personal data, and that's a whole other argument.
But it's,
kind
like,
of
it's the equivalent
something.
Of the three web content thing, isn't it? It's like you come to our websites, we're going to deliver ads. If you add ad blockers, you're essentially freeloading.
Yeah.
Interesting. Mm. Okay, so we'll see how this pans out. What do you think, Henry? Do you think... So the three being blocked from buying O2, is that the end of this story? Or are they going
I don't
to keep
think
going?
So. I think Three or Hutchison, they have enough money to make it legal, you know, sort of to take it to the man.
Sure.
They're probably going to not go down without a fight. But I think it is a little bit odd in terms of the past few years because you've had deals in like Germany and Austria where one operator's bought the other one and it's just kind of been waved through by the same authorities.
Yeah.
So it's going to be interesting to see why exactly it's not been allowed to happen in the UK.
Do you know why Telefonica wants to sell O2, by the way?
I don't really know. Because
they're in every country in the world. It seems odd that they would exit the UK.
I'm not too sure, which is probably something I should know.
I don't know. I mean, I think it would be speculation anyway. It intrigued me.
I think probably 12.5 billion. They probably like that.
Yeah, bit of cash money.
Yeah.
Always goes down well. Okay, brilliant. Thank you, guys. Let's go around the room. Network gains or caught in a network? Don't know what that means. Positive or negative?
Neutral, I think. I was a bit baffled by quite a lot of that, which I'm ashamed to admit.
No, that's good. Do you, Christopher? Do you still think David is the scum of the
the cleaning product of the
cleaning product of the sky?
Cleaning product of the sky.
Excellent. Henry, network gains or caught in a network?
I'm still caught in a network.
Yeah, Christopher.
Yeah, I'm good for all networks.
Okay. Chris Martin, any thoughts?
Don't buy your phone on a contract.
No, that's very true. That's really, really sound advice. And also, if you live in a built-up urban area, you've got a big choice on Sims as well, because you can go for companies like GIFGAF, who will give you... Chris will just punch the air.
Represent.
who will give you a really good deal on the best connectivity available through that Sim. But yeah, it is always the best decision to buy your phone outright and then get your Sim separate. Just saying. Good. Okay. Thanks for listening to this edition of the UK Tech Weekly podcast, listener. It was a long one, but I think it was worth it to get through such weighty matters of philosophy, war, history, and cleaning products in the sky. Do get in touch. Let us know your thoughts and opinions and shake us down for cash. Or indeed, if you're interested in advertising, you can tweet us at UK Tech Podcast or email editor@IDGUK. We will be back next week with more informed opinion on the hottest topics in tech. Until then, don't forget to subscribe, to review, and tell all your friends about how awesome this listening experience was. And when we see you next week, I will now say goodbye, guys.
See you later. Bye.
It's very confusing.
UK Tech Weekly Podcast.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.